6. Rhyme and other noises. Mr. Harris, plutocrat, wants to give my cheek a pat. If a Harris pat means a Paris hat, bébé. Mais je suis toujours fidèle, darling, in my fashion. Oui, je suis toujours fidèle, darling, in my way. I think these lines from a song by Cole Porter, 1891 to 1964, include my favourite rhyme. The lines are blindingly simple, but utterly ingenious in the way they manipulate Harris, plutocrat, Pat, and then carry the sounds into the brilliant inversion of Harris Pat and Paris Hat. The song, Always True to You in My Fashion, from Porter's musical Kiss Me Kate, 1948, plays a series of such rhymes, vet, pet, tex, checks, sex, and it would not be impossible to believe that a less decorous version might have made the Harris wordplay yet better by substituting ass for cheek. Rhyme is a play with words, and its first effect is pleasure. It comes from delighted surprise as words remote from each other in meaning, but which happen to sound alike, are made to coincide. One aspect of this delight can sport with meaning. Moses supposes his toeses are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously. Rhyme can make language disorderly, because following its nose can entirely subvert normal sense, especially when words are corrupted to fit. But in other ways, rhyme might be said to organize language into tidy shapes. There is a kind of click as this happens, like the neat fastening of a catch or two pieces of a jigsaw. With Porter's Conjuring, this occurs with such bewildering speed that we are still figuring out what has happened as the song celebrates not only the characters, but also the composer's coup. Rhyme is often, as here, a matter of surface, and gains the kind of admiration we give to a magic or acrobatic trick. But good rhymes can also embody meaning, and we can see this here. The cheerfully and endearingly cynical character, who sings Porter's song, has a formula that works. The euphemistic, Harris Pat, equals a Paris hat. Algebra could not provide a neater equation. Against rhyming. It must be said at the outset that many poets have done without the various qualities of rhyme. Shakespeare and the other Elizabethan dramatists employed predominantly blank verse as part of their simulation of natural speech on stage, though in his sonnets and other non-dramatic verse, Shakespeare retained rhyme. When Milton came to write Paradise Lost, he dismissed the troublesome and modern bondage of rhyming, which had vexed many previous poets by its constraint to express many things otherwise, and for the most part, worse than else they could have expressed them. He described it in his preface to Paradise Lost as a thing of itself, to all judicious ears, trivial and of no true musical delight, which consists only in apt numbers, fit quantity of syllables, and the sense variously drawn out from one verse into another. Editor A. Fowler, Milton, Paradise Lost, 1971, page 39. Milton's objections that searched for the jingling sound of like endings inhibits free expression have been shared by many poets ever since, especially in the 20th century. Judith Wright, 1915 to 2000, writes in her manifesto poem, Brevity, rhyme, my old symbol. I don't clash you as often or trust your old promises of music and unison. Nevertheless, many people still like and expect poems to rhyme. And despite hundreds of years of blank verse and 100 years of free verse, rhyme is far from dead. Perhaps this is because its pleasures are felt in very different parts of the poetic spectrum. On the one hand, rhyme is indispensable to all kinds of oral poetry, from children's rhymes, folk songs and ballads, to the rap and performance poetry of our own day, because it is a strong sound effect, and for the mnemonic qualities we've discussed. Yet it can also offer the delight of surprise, of enjoying and admiring ingenuity, as in the kind of cerebral, knowing sophistication shown by Cole Porter. In the ever-popular form of the limerick, it can combine both these dimensions and please nearly everyone. When we consider rhyme in any poem, however, we will always want to decide whether it is a thing of itself or a deeply integrated part of the expression. Definition. In the rest of this chapter, I want to describe and explore the definitions and the different kinds, patterns, and purposes of rhyme. This will include considering its aesthetic effects, how it works to provide closure to poems and parts of poems, and how sometimes it does not, how it helps to structure poems, and how rhyme confirms meanings and helps us to discover them. Whilst most attention will be given to end rhymes, I shall also consider related sound effects such as alliteration and assonance and consonance. According to the New Princeton Encyclopedia of Poetry and Poetics, although every language contains the capacity for rhyme, there are some 4,000 poetries which make no use of it. In English, however, poems have often been known as rhymes, so closely has this feature been associated with the art. Rhyme is another characteristic that comes through the oral tradition, and an additional mnemonic feature in early verse. It has always persisted in popular forms such as Cockney rhyming slang, and is intrinsic to rapping and much contemporary performance or slam poetry. Again, recurrence is at the heart of the pleasures of rhyme. Essentially, it exploits an aspect of the coincidence of language. As I've already suggested in Chapter 1, language works not only along the axis of reference, meaning, but also among its own incidental associations. The chance that two words sound similar is one of these, and one with a great range of available subtlety. Thus, a poem in rhyme is working along two axes, one travelling horizontally along the line of its syntactically organized meaning, and another travelling vertically down the line that connects the rhyming words. It's like an echo that still reverberates as the words move on. The relationship between these two axes is what determines how successful a poem in rhyme is. It should possess and connect reason and rhyme. The definition of rhyme in English has to do with the arrangements of consonants and vowels. The family of rhyming effects can be described in the following 7 types thus. C equals the consonant, V equals the vowel. The recurring sound is noted. 1. CVC. CVC. E.g., bat bit equals alliteration, sometimes called head rhyme. 2. CVC. CVC, e.g., cool, food, equals assonance. 3. CVC, CVC, e.g., knack, sock, equals consonance. Could just be used as an end rhyme. 4. CVC, CVC, e.g., sock, rock, equals full or strict rhyme. 5. C v C. C v C. E.g. crick, crack equals half or slant or pararhyme. 6. C v C. C v C. E.g. knack, gnat equals reverse rhyme. 7. C v C. C v C. E.g. wood or wood equals identical rhyme or rhyme reach. Purists would argue that the only proper rhyming is full rhyme, number 4, where the last two or more sounds are identical and the difference is in the preceding consonant. Sock or rock, B, C, raft, daft, bill, fill, null, bull, etc. Two polysyllables that illustrate this are demonstrate and remonstrate. The kinship of these two words is, however, disappointingly close to make a good rhyme. We would certainly prefer a greater difference, something like Tom Harrison's 1937 to date, matching hemorrhoid and unemployed in his Divisions 2. Notice here that the success of the rhyme also depends on the rhythmic combination of syllables. The rhyming sound coming at the end of the line is obviously part of the final stressed syllable, roid, ployed. But the cadence of the word has also to fit the rhythm of the line as a whole. Employed would fill the rhyme, but would not synchronize as unemployed does. Health, H changed to W, for all, with its never have another hemorrhoid, is all that decorates the tap room wall of this pub for pensioners and unemployed. Patterns of rhyme. Poets employ end rhymes in a variety of patterns. The most apparent is the rhyming of successive lines into couplets, as here in Mary Barber's 1690 to 1757, the conclusion of a letter to the Reverend Mr. C. Her husband has surely a terrible life. There's nothing I dread like a verse-writing wife. Defend me, ye powers, from that fatal curse, which must heighten the plagues of for better, for worse. In analysing verse, we give each rhyme sound a letter, beginning with A. So these lines can be seen to rhyme AABB. Triplets, as in to Sappho by Robert Herrick, therefore go Sappho, I will choose to go, where the northern winds do blow, endless ice and endless snow, rather than I once would see, but a winter's face in thee, to benumb my hopes and me. AAABBB. Or, in Gertrud Snackenberg's 1953 to date, Supernatural Love. My father at the dictionary stand touches the page to fully understand, the lamplit answer tilting in his hand. AAA. Whereas couplets are commonly employed in extended verse paragraphs, triplets usually form separate stanzas, although they may, like Schnackenberg's poem, run the syntax from one stanza to the next. Stanzas often built around alternating rhyme schemes, such as this ABAB scheme, also by Hendrick. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may, old time is still a-flying, and this same flower that smiles today, tomorrow will be dying. Alternatively, a quatrain might rhyme its outside lines and its inside lines in a pattern of ABBA, as does Ben Jonson, 1572 to 1637, in An Elegy. Though beauty be the mark of praise, and yours of whom I sing be such, as not the world can praise too much, yet is to your virtue now I raise. These basic patterns, AABB, ABAB, ABBA, all highlight the obvious binary qualities of rhyme, with all its implications of balance, symmetry, and the division and completeness of even numbers. The pairings of rhyme imply that nothing is odd, loose, or stands apart. It is an aesthetic of harmony and completion. As we shall see, longer stanza forms can use more elaborate rhyme schemes as part of the structure of the poem. As they do so, the rhymes might appear much further apart, some seemingly abandoned until they are given their more remote echo. It is in the identification of such structures and echoes that the notation of rhyme is so helpful. The beauties of rhyme. The aesthetic attraction, the beauties of rhyme, is very different. Sometimes we might gorge on a wonderful excess, as in a poem like Carol Ann Duffy's, 1955 to date, Mrs. Sisyphus, 1999, which plays exultantly on the words jerk, kirk, irk, burk, dirk, perk, shriek, cork, park, dork, gawk, quirk, lark, and mark. There's plentitude too in these quatrains from Long After Henny by Gwen Harwood, 1920 to 95, which combine internal rhyme, rhyme within the line, with ingenious end rhyme. The baby screamed with colic, the windows steamed with rain. She dreamed of a demon lover, like Richard Chamberlain. He towered austerely perfect, in samurai brocade, and hushed the howling baby with one swish of his blade. I've highlighted here not only the full end and internal rhymes, but also the assonance of vowel sounds, towered, austerely, samurai, and alliteration of hushed, howling, as well as the half rhyme, hushed, swished. These are comic examples, but the religious poetry of George Herbert also works with rhyme to shape his affirmations. This is the first stanza of Virtue. Sweet day, so cool, so calm, so bright, the bridal of the earth and sky, the dew shall weep thy fall tonight, for thou must die. The next two of the four ABAB quatrains employ different rhymes for the key words die, I, and lie. None of these is exotic, for simplicity is everything in this poem. In the last stanza, die is replaced by its opposite in meaning, lives. Only a sweet and virtuous soul, like seasoned timber, never gives, but though the whole world turn to coal, then chiefly lives. The attraction of this poem is in its carefully judged composure. Its meter is simple and steady, and the process of its imagery and ideas is paralleled in each of the first three stanzas with that recurrent, crucial rhyme of the IE sound. Then, as the rhyme changes, so does the sense. The poem has the pleasures of calmness, compact shape and balance, and the straightforward rhymes are an important part of this. They show us that whilst we may think of the effects of rhyme as something in themselves, especially when the juxtapositions have real surprise, rhyme is really set into the whole character and meaning of the poem. Rhyming and meaning. Because of its binary character, rhyme is often used for closure of various kinds. The two parts come together like the shutting of a lid. A familiar example is the way that Shakespearean verse drama usually indicates the end of a scene by rhyming couplet. The exhaustion of King Lear is told in a sequence of four rhyming couplets, including the last words of the faithful servant Kent. I have a journey, sir, shortly to go. My master calls me. I must not say no. Couplets like this are called closed, because they contain a whole sentiment or idea within their clearly defined boundaries. It is a stichic verse, which is to say that the poem proceeds mainly through distinctly punctuated lines, as opposed to verse that flows through several lines. To 18th century neoclassical poets, who saw verse as primarily rhetorical, that is a way of clarifying and persuading an audience of long-established truths. The couplet is attractive because of its capacity for memorable summary. It is its association with the effort of speech-making and grand persuasion that have gained this kind of couplet the title heroic. For important summations or conclusions, the couplet can have an epigrammatic quality, sometimes using humour and the surprise of the rhyme to achieve a deflating effect. This is well shown in these lines by John Gay, 1685 to 1732. The poem is called The Man and the Flea, and features a series of creatures, a hawk, a crab, a snail, and, of course, a man, discoursing upon how all creation has been made for their particular benefit. Man boasts, "I cannot raise my worth too high. Of what vast consequence am I?" And gets an unexpected riposte. "Not of the importance, you suppose," replies a flea upon his nose. "Be humble, learn thyself to scan. No, pride was never made for man. 'Tis vanity that swells thy mind. What, heaven and earth for thee designed? For thee, made only for our need, that more important fleas might feed." The pride of man is instantly deflated by this unlooked-for intervention, which opens the pretensions of high I to the ridicule of a flea. A flea educated enough, moreover, to employ words like suppose. Man cannot see what's on his nose, never mind what's under it. Thus, suppose, nose, is a rhyme that is not merely incidental, but essential to the meaning and tone of the poem. In lines longer than Gay's four-beat tetrameter, this summative quality of the rhyming couplet can be complemented by related devices, as in these lines by the style's foremost exponent, Alexander Pope, 1688 to 1744. Here, in An Essay on Criticism, he wants to square the paradox that what we take to be natural and thus think of as free and unconstrained is in fact governed by laws of its own. "Those rules of old discovered, not devised, are nature still, but nature methodized. Nature, like liberty, is but restrained by the same laws which first herself ordained." In this instance, the pair of rhyming words, devised, methodized, and restrained, ordained, are associated in their meaning, as well as in the coincidence of their sound. The second couplet, moreover, encapsulates a move in understanding. This goes from the notion of restraint alone, which we might think of as a troublesome leash, to the acknowledgement that the natural order is fixed. Pope is aiming to build an argument, and so tries to carry us along the line of his thought in a series of clear, separate steps. To this end, the balanced self-containment of the rhyme is often paralleled by a balancing effect within the iambic pentameter. Usually this will involve a tiny break, or caesura, halfway through the line. The previous lines illustrate this, although, as so often in verse, the variation from it is equally important. "Those rules of old discovered, not devised, are nature still, but nature methodized. Nature, like liberty, is but restrained by the same laws which first herself ordained." The caesura, in the first line here, is delayed so as to emphasize the assertion and push the opposite idea back before it. The alliteration, or head rhyme, helps drive home the essential idea, discovered, not devised. The second line is evenly balanced with nature, on both sides of the equation, pivoting on but. The third line allows an extra pause after nature to allow us to dwell on the relationship between nature and liberty. But then, the line runs on into the next, sweeping us along to its firm conclusion without any further break. That everything is ordained, with the strong implication of divine ordinance, is for Pope the last word. Although, the closed couplet can be used for more intimate purposes, as here in Pope's Epistle to Dr. Arbuthnot. The muse but served to ease some friend, not wife, to help me through this long disease, my life. Its primary mode is public and oratorical. This is less true of open couplets, where the sense can run on through lines, with much less punctuation, without necessarily matching components of meaning to the rhyming pairs. In these lines from Christopher Marlowe's 1564-93 poem Hero and Leander, the narrator is striving to describe the beauties of the handsome youth Leander. Even as delicious meat is to the taste, so was his neck in touching, and surpassed the white of Pelops' shoulder. I could tell ye how smooth his breast was, and how white his belly, and whose immortal fingers did imprint that heavenly path with many a curious dint that runs along his back. But my rude pen can hardly blazon forth the loves of men, much less of powerful gods. These lines are rapturous rather than studied, and the sensual excitement does not accept the measure of the couplet, but flows enthusiastically across the endings. In running, or strophic, lines like these, the rhyme is much less important, serving the overall organization of the verse rather than its specific meanings. As Marlowe's own dramatic verse shows, when the pentameter is used like this, rhyme becomes redundant, since the necessary pressure in the verse is felt in other ways. But not all open couplets tend towards blank verse. In this poem, the Not Returning, Ivor Gurney, 1890-1937, imagines his home from the trenches of the Western Front. Never more delight comes of the roof, dark lit, with under candle flicker nor rich gloom on it, the limbed faces and moving hands shuffling the cards, the clear conscience, the free mind moving towards poetry, friends, the old earthly rewards. No more they come, no more. Only the restless searching, the bitter labour, the going out to watch stars, stumbling blind through the difficult door. As in this excerpt, Gurney's poem uses a mixture of couplets and triplets. Unusually, too, for rhyming verse, the measure is irregular. So, what purpose does the rhyme serve here? I think that in this case, the customary tidying qualities of rhyme are an ironic counterpoint to the roughed-out quality of the verse. The last phrase, stumbling blind through the difficult door, is the poem's keynote. In its awkward word order, never more delight comes, and its varying verse lines and punctuation, the poem embodies a sense of stumbling. It seems written under stress, almost improvised. The rhymes then represent some object to stumble towards, something to help keep coherence, as the speaker feels everything dissolving. That the rhyme, lit, on it, is crude and is succeeding by two triplets, which include half rhymes, shows how ironically distant these agonized, nearly broken lines are from the finish we usually associate with rhyme. That it bothers with such artifice seems an irrelevance, but that it does so turns out to sound poignant and defiant. Building poems with rhymes. I want to turn now to see how rhyme schemes work as part of the architecture of whole poems, or the larger sections of poems. The complete sequence of AABBCC is plain rhyme, but as soon as rhyming words are separated further, even only to AB, AB, then the lines connecting the rhymes crisscross, and the rhyme becomes interlaced. Terza rima is a good basic example of this. It works in three-line units, ABA, BCB, CDC. This is the opening of Thomas Kinsella's 1928 to 2021 Downstream. Again in the mirrored dusk, the paddles sank. We thrust forward, swaying both as one. The ripples widened to the ghostly bank, where willows with their shadows half undone hung to the water, mowing like the blind. The current seized our skiff, we let it run. Grazing the reeds and letting the land unwind, in stealth on either hand, dark woods, a door, opened and shut, the clear sky fell behind. ABA, BCB, CDC. Terza rima was devised by the Italian poet Dante, 1265 to 1321, for his huge three-part poem, The Divine Comedy, and has found counterparts in the poetries of several European languages since. His choice of these tercets within his three-part scheme was meant to allude to the Holy Trinity, but more generally, the mode suggests forward movement and continuity. The closed couplet can be seen to be continually starting afresh, but with terza rima, there is a sense of perpetual motion and of everything being connected. The closure occurs with a single line, rhyming with the previous middle rhyme, as Kinsella does in his own very Dantean poem. The slow downstreaming dead, it seemed, were blended, one with those silver hordes and briefly shared, their order glittering and then impeded, a barrier of rock that turned and bared, a varied barrenness as toward its base. We glided, blotting heaven as it towered, searching the darkness for a landing place. On the face of it, it seems strange that rhyme, which depends upon evenness, should work to bind three-line systems so strongly. The villanelle, originally a French form, is a more compact example. This is a form comprising five three-line stanzas, tercets, each rhyming ABA, and a closing quatrain rhyming ABAA. The first and third lines of stanza one are also repeated alternately at the end of each succeeding stanza, culminating in the reappearance of both as the last two lines of the poem. Strictly, the rhymes should also be the same full sounds throughout. Here are the first two stanzas of Dylan Thomas's 1914-53 elegy for his father. Do not go gentle into that good night. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning they, do not go gentle into that good night. Thomas confines himself, throughout, to end words which rhyme with night or day, two words, of course, which represent the poles within the poem's subject. To fashion such a feverishly emotional poem, rage, rage against the dying of the light. Within this extreme discipline, produces a special tension. The strict limitations on the poem's means, especially in the tight permissions of the rhyme scheme, construct a vessel to compress and withstand the pressure of the poem's feeling. In Lycidas, in memory of his drowned friend, King Edward, Milton shapes a highly individual version of the elegy, which varies its line length, and instead of stanzas, employs strophic verse paragraphs of different duration. Rhyme is also used in unexpected ways that move between plain and interlaced patterns. In this fifth paragraph, The poet is asking one of the commonest angry questions of the grief-stricken. How could the divine powers allow this to happen? Associating King Lycidas with poetry, he concludes with the anguished recollection that in the ancient Greek myth, the muse could not intervene to save even her own son, the greatest of poets, Orpheus. Where were ye nymphs, when the remorseless deep closed o'er the head of your beloved Lycidas? For neither were ye playing on the steep, where your old bards, the famous druids, lie, nor on the shaggy top of Mona High, nor yet where Diva spreads her wizard stream, ay me, I fondly dream. Had ye been there, for what could that have done? What could the muse herself that Orpheus bore? The muse herself for her enchanting son, whom universal nature did lament, when by the rout that made the hideous roar, his gory visage down the stream was sent, down the swift Hebrus to the Lesbian shore. ABA CCDD EFE GFGF. The rhymes in the first seven lines have stayed plain, but then, as the poet becomes more fraught, the pace accelerates and the pattern changes. As we see, the vision of Orpheus's severed head tumbling downriver to the sea, the rhymes rush over one another, a tumult caught in the only triple rhyme, boar, roar, shore. Words we feel here as deep, harsh sounds. The first pairing is separated by two lines, the second by only one. These words beat heavily through the lines. We will see as well that the paragraph contains one solitary, unrhymed line. Line 2, the abandoned Lycidas. When Milton brings his poem to its resolved conclusion, 130 lines later, he gives his final paragraph the conventional harmony of ottava rima, a stanza form, rhyming AB, 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 CC. This fifth paragraph has no such orderly convention, but the way the poet patterns both sections, irregular and regular, shows how important rhyme is to the structure of the poem. All these instances of the different ways rhyme is used show the connection between rhyme and meaning. But rhyme does always depend upon coincidence, and its use might just be a celebration of the happy anarchy within the language that enables us to bring words together that would otherwise never keep company. Like Tony Harrison rhyming la-di-da and Panama. We might exult, for instance, in discovering the rhyme in loan words in English, such as crouton, futon, and make the most of it by working up a poem about breadcrumbs. Some poems might be generated by preset rhymes, throwing their intentions entirely upon the mercy of rhyming accidents, or, as some have done, upon another's isolated rhymes, which the poet then writes to words, as does John Ashbery, 1927 to 2017, in The Plural of Jack in the Box, where, having found his rhyme words stands, hands, grace, place, etc., composed a new sonnet making use of them. So, is rhyme a thing in itself? Thinking about rhyme in this way takes us once more into the great poetic conundrum. Does the poem find words to refine its intended meanings, the emotion or idea which is there? As the philosopher Collingwood says, before we express it, or are its meanings generated out of the energies of language? Dylan Thomas's rhymes in Do Not Go Gentle evidently belong in the first category, for his choices, night, light, bright, sight, belong predominantly in the same area of meaning, or semantic field, as linguists call it, and others, right, flight, height, and day, way, pray, can all be seen to belong in the arena where we might think of death and dying. They form that vertical axis of association as the poem proceeds horizontally along and through its lines, since they in line 5 is a pronoun and less substantive than any other of the rhyme words. It might be said to be out of key with the rest of the poem, though this would be a harsh judgment. Another poem in which we can readily recognise the associations, if not the separate meanings of the rhyme words, is Ben Jonson's On My First Son. Farewell, thou child of my right hand, and joy. My sin was too much hope of thee, loved boy. 7 years thou wert lent to me, and I thee pay, exacted by thy fate on the just day. Oh, could I lose all father now, for why? Will man lament the state he should envy? To have so soon scaped world's and flesh's rage, and if no other misery yet age. Rest in soft peace, and ask'd say, here doth lie Ben Jonson, his best piece of poetry. For whose sake henceforth all his vows be such, as what he loves may never like too much. The hard self-reproachful thought here is that the poet invested too much in the joy of having a child, and prepared himself too little for what fate might bring. Still hard, and raging with exclamation, is the question of why he did not envy the release death brings, most of all from the trials of age. If there is one surprising rhyme, it is lie poetry. This is the idea most peculiar to the poet, and it might be objected to, this drawing of attention to his craft has no necessary place in the lament. We might think that, even as he is saying that all his poetry is as naught compared with his son, he is reminding us that he is a poet. The defence would be that this discounting of his art is part of throwing off delusion and vanity. We might even consider whether Jonson intends, or subconsciously produces, a pun on lies, in the sense of deceit, thus associating, as writing of the period often did, poetry and untruth. The closing couplet, such, much, has a roughness to it, befitting the baleful resolution to make this awful distinction between loving and liking. Throughout this poem, there is a heavy-minded restraint in the way the rhyme words are fixed together. This is very different from the rhyming of this next poem, which, in subject and style, is a modern imitation of 16th and 17th century modes. This is the ABBA-ABBA octet of Sonnet 23 by John Berryman, 1914-72. They may suppose, but I would not cloy your ear, if ever these songs by others' ears are heard. With love, suppose I loved you not, but blurred, lust with strange images, warm but not quite sincere. To switch a bedroom black, O mutineer, with me against these empty captains, gird your scorn against above all at this word. Pompous and vague on the stump of his career. As a set, heard, blurred, word can be seen to have some affinity, but it is not shared by gird, while ear, sincere, mutineer, career appear to have none at all. But as the central exclamation exhorts, the poem is raising a mutiny against the conventions of the love sonnet. With its familiar circuit of love, heart, and beauty, I want a verse fresh, as a bubble breaks, he writes in the sonnet's sestet. And this will involve unexpected rhymes, more promiscuous than chaste, in their associations. Berryman and Jonson have quite different approaches to rhyming. We might imagine Jonson looking down his classical nose at Berryman's extrovert style, and indeed think ourselves that he makes rhyme, as Milton says, a thing in itself, rather than something that serves the poem's sentiment and ideas. But whichever our preference, We can see how both poets employ rhyme as part of their total meaning, not just as a bolted-on device. As we have seen, there are several kinds of correspondences in the company of rhyme, from the head rhymes of alliteration, the chimes of assonance, through half rhymes, to the full, prominent end rhymes of the couplet. Rhymes can also echo from the middle of lines, or diagonally from end to middle or back. Emily Dickinson, 1830 to 1886, is one of the subtlest and most determined technicians of rhyme. One reason she is so is that her poems seem at first so artless, even clumsy, and so conventional as to resemble nursery rhymes, or the most mundane of hymns. But we soon see that here is an exceptional verbal intelligence which undermines the conventions she works with to produce, through her wry styling, the most astonishing sentiments and ideas. She makes much use of half rhyme, both in endings and across the bodies of lines. A recluse herself, it is perhaps not surprising to see how often the word room appears in her work, and in only a handful of poems, we can find it rhymed with tomb, name, storm, and firm. This obliqueness is entirely characteristic and part of her philosophy, as when she writes, "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant, success in circuit lies." This first stanza of a burial poem, #216, in the standard edition, for she gave none of her poems titles, encapsulates the variety of her rhyming. I have highlighted all the rhyming effects. Safe in their alabaster chambers, untouched by morning and untouched by noon, lie the meek members of the resurrection, rafter of satin and roof of stone. The crisscrossing here is very intricate. We can see, for instance, how noon and stone are half rhymes, and how they slant to bring in the S and T sounds of satin. This echo in satin and stone is especially effective because of the opposite nature of the substances associated here in the material of the coffin and the tomb, both so far from the light of noon. Similarly, the assonance of rafter and satin, the one word reminding us of hardness, the other of softness, combine, as do the consonants of rafter and roof. Moreover, we might see in rafter a I rhyme, that is, a combination of letters that look as though they might rhyme, although they do not, with the poem's first word, safe. There are other delicate and eerie effects, which help create the unnerving sense of this stanza, such as the steady and then varying pace and beat of the rhythm. Then there is that astonishingly rich word, alabaster, whose A sounds are different from the others in that line, and carry such connotations of deathly, clay-like whiteness. But the web of rhyming effects ensures complex associations between different words, and leads to more and more implications. Dickinson's brilliance lies exactly in her understanding of that fascinating paradox of rhyme. Its belonging in both simple and sophisticated modes. It is a brief, enigmatic poem, but one that shows so much of what the poet has available in rhyme and other sounds. Summary. In this chapter on rhyme, we have considered rhyme and wordplay, arguments against using rhyme, blank verse, definitions of different kinds of rhyme, the character of different rhyme schemes, the aesthetic purposes of rhyme and how rhyme can enhance meaning, how rhyme schemes can shape a whole poem, a summary of the arguments for and against the use of rhyme.